Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Headlines first of all, and as you can imagine, Tiger Roll is dominating the back pages. It was extraordinary. High of the Tiger is the back page of the Mail on Sunday. Storming finish lands back-to-back nationals. It's a picture of Davy Russell standing up on Tiger Roll, hands in the air, and it was just an extraordinary performance an afternoon yesterday at Aintree. As you can imagine, it's right across all the papers. Sunday Independent next. Same picture, I think, of Davy Russell, yeah, standing up in the saddle, hands in the air. Tiger Roll earns iconic status with repeat national victory, and then beneath that, City survive off day to ease into cup final, their 1-0 win against Brighton in the FA Cup semi-final last night. So that's the Sunday Independent. Sunday Times, more smiling from Davy Russell. National treasure is the headline. Tiger Roll joins Red Rum in history books by claiming back-to-back Aintree triumphs. Grand National reports inside, just the fifth horse ever to do it, and the first in, what, 45, 46 years. And then this is an interesting story as well. It seems like there is a serious exodus about to happen at Manchester United. It's their front page story on the Sunday Times. Man United stars make summer exit plans. And this is Duncan Castles. So it seems that a growing number of Manchester United's key players are considering leaving in the summer. A seven-strong group that includes Paul Pogba and David De Gea are being tempted, especially with Champions League football looking less likely. So Pogba, it seems, is headed for Zinedine Zidane and Real Madrid. De Gea has been targeted by Madrid as well as PSG and Juventus. He's unhappy that they won't make him their highest paid player. De Gea is free to sign a pre-contract with all of those suitors in 9 months' time. Next January, he's free to sign a contract elsewhere at the age of 28. Lukaku, it seems, is very open about his future, is the quote from the agent there. United are going to lose Ander Herrera. He's agreed a deal with PSG. Juan Mata is out of contract at the end of the season and seems to be going to Barcelona. And Eric Bailly is unhappy with his playing time. While finally, Alexis Sanchez understood to regret his January 2018 decision to move to Old Trafford rather than Man City. So there you go. Over to you, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. The Sun go with nuts. Houghton hits the roof at Kyle's VAR escape for headbutt yesterday. And then you'll see in the top right corner, Old Rum 2. And it's Davy Russell again looking very happy. Back page of the Star. Tiger on a roll, but O'Leary won't target Rum record. Michael O'Leary saying that he doesn't think he has any chance next year. Or sorry, I didn't think he had any chance even this year, having gone up in weight. It's unlikely he'll come back here next year. He's already a legend, is what Michael O'Leary said yesterday. But look, who knows? And then Sunday Mirror, Milan go all Poch. It seems AC Milan are hunting down Pochettino. Again, a picture of Davy Russell in the corner. And then finally, the Sunday World. Davy Russell lifting the trophy and a picture of him on Tiger Roll. Tiger roars. And then Rice to riches. Some good news for Manchester United fans. Declan Rice very much on their to-do list this summer. So they are your back pages. We have Kieran Shannon with us from the Irish Examiner, whose interviews I'm sure you read, and who works as a sports psychologist, high-performance coach with various teams, and Colm Keyes across all things GAA for the Irish Independent as well. Gents, you're both very welcome.
Thanks, Joe.
I've just realised I forgot the other. The last month you need to show news sections as well on this slot. So this is on the Sunday Times, it's the only one I'm going to show you. FAI refuses to say Delaney will face loan probe. The Sunday Times yesterday got in touch with the FAI to double check that John Delaney will attend the Oireachtas Committee this Wednesday. And a spokesperson for the FAI said delegates would be confirmed tomorrow. Until then, we have no further comment to make, is on the front page of the Sunday Times. We'll come back to that in a moment. And a picture of Michael O'Leary and his wife enjoying an amazing day yesterday. You're a racing fan, Colm. It was an extraordinary performance.
It was. No, absolutely no doubt about it. Michael O'Leary suggests he's not going to bring Tiger Roll back to Aintree for a third, for an attempt at the third in succession, Joe. But I suspect he doesn't want to buy the Ryanair passengers three drinks, because last year it was one, last night it was two.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he's going to recoil from purchasing three next year, because I think on the Aintree Grand National is designed for horses not to win 2 years running, obviously with a handicap. That's the way it's designed. It's almost like the draft in American football and sport. But the way he won it yesterday was just absolutely magnificent. For a horse that 5 years ago won a Triumph Hurdle as a four-year-old in Cheltenham over 2 miles and is able to take on the Aintree fences, the cross-country chase twice, has won four times in Cheltenham. and now twice back to back. And if you think, you know, of a certain vintage, Red Rum was a standout horse for a lot of people. Mm. And now Tiger Roll, this diminutive horse, has gone and matched his feet in winning back-to-back entry. Red Rum went and won a third 3 years after his second. There was a considerable gap there. But Tiger Roll is probably still very, very well placed to go back into. He's a 9-year-old at 10 years of age, coming into some element of maturity even at that stage for a race of that significance and that length. So I think he's very well positioned to come back. Michael didn't think he was hopefully just get round yesterday. I think he was probably shortchanging in his pre-race interview in that regard. He was a commanding favourite and justified everything yesterday in what the National is about. So terrific performance, I would say. The National Hunt horse of his age at this stage, given the breadth of his successes.
Yeah.
And very touching from Davy Russell to mention Kieran O'Connor among many others yesterday in his immediate post-race. Davy really gets to the heart of things, wears his heart on his sleeve very much so, and showed it again yesterday in, you know, arguably his finest moment of triumph.
Yeah, Russell's a tough man and yet an incredibly emotional man.
Yeah.
Real emotional intelligence, and is always thinking of the bigger picture, you find. And his father being there was one of the lovely stories as well, who wasn't there last year. Russell's mother passed away shortly before the Grand National last year, and his father came over this year. You don't expect to come and see your son retain the Grand National.
Yeah.
So that was magic. Don McLean opens his piece by saying, special horse, special occasion, special achievement. And he goes on to reference Red Rum, but he says, Tiger Roll is as unlikely as he is worthy. Like Red Rum, Tiger Roll was bred to race on the flat. And elsewhere, David Walsh has a piece where Eddie O'Leary states that at first he wasn't a very good jumper. He's still not a great jumper, but he's a jumper that never falls.
Yeah, it's that he just barely gets over the fences. That's the quality of it. But it's just his speed, his ability to just maintain a steady pace. You could see 4 or 5 fences out that he was creeping ever closer and made a mistake. I think it was at the fourth last, but quickly recovered and coming down the home stretch, there was only one winner, and I think the crowd really, really responded as well. It was one of racing's better occasions.
Yeah, 4-1 favourite as well in the Grand National.
Yeah.
Run a mile, and yet obviously people didn't.
Yeah, it's a great achievement for them.
€80,000 suddenly looks like good business now for Tiger Roll back in the day.
Yeah, which is, it seems a lot at the outset. I mean, it is a lot to probably put up for a National Hunt race. There are no, obviously, breeding doesn't, although he was bred for the flat, it seems quite a lot, but the value is considerable at this stage. Even, it's the diversity of races that the horse has won, from the cross-country chase twice in Cheltenham, which presents different obstacles up and down banks and different nature fences, to the fences at Aintree, to the Triumph Hurdle at speed with 4-year-olds that can go anywhere and do anything. They're, you know, almost out of control that race at times with young horses, but he's gone through it all. So it's the diversity of race that he has been able to win that makes it.
Penny for Davy Russell's thoughts. If back when Michael O'Leary sat him down for a cup of tea and said, "This isn't working out, my friend. We're going to have to part ways." Fast forward to 2019, and you're there on the Ryanair flight with Michael O'Leary, having won your second Grand National in a row.
Yeah, that is an amazing turnaround. He has hung in there, Davy Russell. And you mentioned earlier, he's a tough character. He's a tough character, and obviously did not let that get to him. Was one of a number of big races, both in Cheltenham, right through England and Ireland. He has won some very significant races, but he's a tough customer, as I said. But at a critical moment, wears his heart in its sleeve. So he's very much one of racing's strongest personalities, and I think he showed that again yesterday.
Yeah, one of the best things about racing coverage are the photographs. If you're even if you're not a racing fan, just flicking through the photos from yesterday, well worth doing. Yeah. We're putting a few there up on the screen. So plenty of coverage of Tiger Roll's win if you're looking for it in the papers today. This John Delaney story on the front page of the Sunday Times is quite surprising, because in one of, don't ask me which one, but there were a number of statements around the Gibraltar game and his announcement that he was moving to the position of executive vice president. But certainly in one of those statements, they made it very clear to the FAI that John Delaney would still be going before the Oireachtas committee. So I'm a bit surprised that the FAI are refusing to comment on the delegates they're sending until tomorrow. Why make this a front page story? If they had simply said, yes, John Delaney will be there, I don't think that'd be front page news, but it's this refusal almost to comment on it, which is another little chink in the optics war that they're pretty much losing quite badly at the moment.
You would have to wonder, is it the source of the inquiry, where did it come from?
Yeah.
Because obviously I think it's the fourth successive weekend now that they have been able to lead with this story. So I would imagine that it may be something to do with that. I would be very surprised at this stage if John Delaney did not go into that meeting on Wednesday and face the committee. Very, very surprised. I think it would be maybe the most significant moment in it. I don't think there would be any future for him if he refused to go in, or if he didn't go in for whatever reason.
Yeah, I'd be very surprised if he didn't.
I would be very surprised. I think he will.
Did either of you keep an eye on John Tracy's performance?
Yeah, and Kieran Mulvey.
4 or 5 errors, yeah.
So it was very revealing. Obviously comes up in the papers today.
Anything grabbing your eye in the papers?
Well, just speaking of the Oireachtas inquiry during the week, Tommy Conlon had a fresh take on it, which was that in the Sunday Indo, that what he took from it was just actually how well the rest of Irish sport is performing in terms of its governance and how the various national governing bodies have got their act together. And it would be pretty aligned from my own observations of both the rest of Irish sport and, let's say, its relationship with Sport Ireland and its various arms, along with and how out of kilter the FAI are with it. And that was the big thing he took from it, was, like, he says that it's like even the behaviour he was talking and the overall culture in Irish sport, how different it is that the FAI is becoming increasingly isolated in an environment which is gravitating towards best practice and higher standards. And the obvious parallel is the actual, as he puts it, the artist formerly known as the Olympic Council, and how it's modernised over the last couple of years. And you can tell from John Tracy's, I suppose, exasperation. I mean, Shane McGrath in the Mail today talks about how it was about, you know, the late correspondence that was going back and forth. But, you know, on Wednesday came the most brazen act of resistance when Sports Ireland chief John Tracy revealed the board of the FAI had written to his organisation, and that it would only be, the loan would only be explained until a review within the FAI, or let's say commissioned by the FAI, and it's a bit like the police investigating the police. That's in terms of credibility. And he says it was a rather brass-necked definition of sport. It was rather brass-necked defiance of Sport Ireland, the body charged with administrating sport in this country and ensuring that any taxpayers' money spent by bodies is accounted for properly. So there'll be fireworks. It was nearly like just a precursor setting it up.
What wasn't one of the things established on Wednesday was that the money appropriated by the Sports Council was reaching the programmes.
Yeah.
That was one of the things.
John Tracy said that in his opening statement.
Yeah.
That the taxpayers' money, which is ring-fenced for
certain
programmes.
They're very happy that that's exactly
spent where it's meant to be spent, yeah. I'm sure Mazzara's will argue they'll do a full and thorough review, as they absolutely will. Shane McGrath remarks on it in his piece, and several people have as well, that it is surprising maybe that an external review is needed to get to the bottom of why the CEO gave the FAI a loan. Surely they're aware of the situation and they could provide that information.
It seems a very, very simple question, that you don't have to go through all this process. If you just, it should be that. Why? And why did it not appear in a certain way and in accordance with? So it does seem that it could be simplified down to one specific question.
You would have thought so. Certainly, John Tracy, I would have said, could have frustrated figure. He was frustrated that the response to the second Sport Ireland letter looking for more information only arrived late the night before and was hand-delivered on the morning of the committee. And then secondly, he was very frustrated that they said, we can't tell you anything more about this loan until after the Mazzara's audit. And he was asked, the most dramatic moment, he was asked, do you have faith in the board?
He was asked, was it four times?
Four times, yeah.
Four times, yeah. And eventually he said, "The answer, I couldn't say yes," which was no.
And he's a reasonably diplomatic person, John Tracy. Like, he didn't go in there all guns blazing.
Yeah, I saw Ewan on Twitter saying, well, why didn't he just come out? But I think, you know, there's such a thing as subtext without actually saying that he didn't have any confidence in him. As he says, I'm not saying yes, which said volumes.
The really interesting question ahead of Wednesday is if the FAI representatives turn up, including John Delaney, and their answer to any question about the loan is, well, we have to await the finding from the Mazars review. That's going to be greeted with a lot of frustration, I would think. I mean, they will be told in no uncertain terms that's unacceptable.
I would think so too. I think this will be an eagerly, obviously it's eagerly awaited and watched interview, and I think they will stick to that line, and I think it will, they'll be stalemate and angry and, as you said, frustrated stalemate, because I think they're trying to kick this further down the road, obviously with this Mazars report that's going to take place. But I don't see how they will give an answer before that, because I think they're obviously trying to buy a bit of time on it.
Yeah.
It'll be what else they'll be asking too, and obviously a thing that's coming under the spotlight is this is beyond a John Delaney issue. This is a, this is an FAI board issue, and your colleague Daniel yesterday highlighted just, it was when you actually just saw the profile of it, and just again how out of sync it is with the rest of Irish sport, both in its age profile, how I suppose beholden they are to the person who put them in that position, and how long they've been working with John Delaney. And also just like, even just on the way up, I was listening again to the Stand podcast with Dunphy, to was interviewing Mark Tighe, who obviously with the Sunday Times, who broke this story. And they were just making the point about looking at who the honorary treasurer of the FAI is a retired Garda, as opposed to the equivalent in the IRFU. Is Tom Grace not just a former player, but also someone who is has worked in the financial services for, you know, PwC? And the query you just would have is that, like, just the sheer groupthink that you'd have to think goes on in, with the FAI, and how just the need for fresh blood, that whatever your take on John Delaney has been, that he's had a good run with it. I mean, when you look at his predecessors only had a couple of years in the job, and you could say under circumstances that weren't any more I suppose dubious than some of the issues that are being highlighted now. It just is a body that you think that is screaming for an overhaul, and although that there's good things done by the FAI, I'd agree with the thrust of what Tommy Conlon was saying, which is that it's always struck me as just it's managed in a culture that is more, I suppose, let alone pre-Saipan or pre-Athens, you know, the 0204, like Irish sport, and we'll probably be coming to Gary Keegan later with, you know, how Irish boxing and then the Institute and Sport Ireland really upped its game as the noughties went on, whereas the FAI is not high performing. And as Gary Keegan says, you know, high performance is something you're either half pregnant, you can't be half pregnant on. And you just get the sense that the FAI, there's a lot of people who are grateful for the service that he's given, but you'd have to say at the moment that nobody should be bigger than an organisation, and you have that situation at the moment.
Abroad, obviously, in terms of UEFA, he's highly rated and highly thought of there, and obviously events have come to Ireland that you wouldn't ordinarily have expected in terms of tournaments and finals and that level of recognition. And I think he's only the second Irish man after Des Casey to sit on a UEFA executive committee. So in those terms, he is of very high standing. But I just think it's a PR battle that the FAI, no matter what, are not going to win. Mm. And there will be a cloud there, and there is a cloud there. Rightly or wrongly, and whatever the pros and cons for it are, there is a cloud there. And 14 years is a long, as Kieran, as you said, it's a long, long time to be chief executive of any organisation or company. Mm. CEOs don't really last that long. They come in and they affect change and do things their way, and they move on. Mm. And I think probably the lesson of the Olympic Council of Ireland is there to look back on as well as a gauge. But I think he obviously has done some good, and there was quite an outpouring, whether orchestrated or not, I don't know, during the week from district boards and whatever else, and he has that UEFA standing. But generally, in the eyes of the public, there is, and Shane McGrath references it there, Wednesday is you know, it's a day of reckoning. Mm. And I think that's what it will be seen as, what is the answer for
It's worth stating, and I don't think you were suggesting otherwise, that the FAI treasurer could be an absolutely competent person and
absolutely
do a very good job. But we are talking about best practice when it comes to corporate governance in terms of turnover rate in the board. That was a big theme on Wednesday. And they talked about other boards which have had turnover 8-9 years is about a good amount to serve on a board is generally what's taken as being best practice. And the FAI has exceeded that in several counts. So that's one of the big issues that they're going to have to successfully answer on Wednesday.
Paul Rowan, the piece is interesting, where he talks about ultimately that a lot of it might just go. What is clear is that if they do not get the answers they want, that a meeting with the sports minister, Shane Ross, isn't far down the line. Mm. It is the minister who has the greatest powers, but he says again, even he has to be careful, as FIFA can intervene and suspend countries where international football, where there is evidence of government interference, FIFA as the ultimate arbiter, it's no wonder that we are where we are. Mm. So it's going to run because, like...
See, I don't know what powers they have, because it was quite striking that Kieran Mulvey and John Tracy were very upfront about the fact that they gave about 2.7 million annually to the FAI, which in the grand scheme of 50 million turnover annually is not very much. Mm. Therefore, their auditing powers are quite limited. Mm. They were saying something like boxing, they give 70-80% of boxing's funding each year. So they can really get in and see how pretty close to every penny is being spent. Mm. They don't have those powers with the FAI. It's a bigger organisation than most. And that's been an issue for them. So it'll be interesting to see if they are unhappy with Wednesday's Oireachtas committee meeting, what powers they have, what happens next. I mean, they can meet with Shane Ross. They can even take the step of suspending funding, which I think they really don't want to do, because
you're
talking
about
really
good grassroots projects. I wouldn't think they do either. I mean, that's who you're impacting on. Mm.
For short-term paying for long-term gain?
There is a case.
And that ultimately that... You know, we're talking about here and early, like, think of the children. But if you think in the long term, it's best for their sport. Like, Sport Ireland have had to go hard on sport. Like, actually, one of his, John Delaney's predecessors would have been Bernard O'Byrne, who knows, in Basketball Ireland, yeah. A sport that had to, was basically blacklisted or, you know, was the naughty child in the Irish sports community for a considerable period of time. There was no international team for 5 or 6 years because the finances that where the finances of the sport was, and it didn't have income from Sport Ireland at the time. But it has got better governance now. It has a vibrant board with people with a range of experience, and again, so that like we've had it with. I think the former Irish Swimming Association, now Swim Ireland, they've also been in the dock like this before, and has emerged all the better for the tough love. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, would Irish football, like even on that, I sometimes think does, like when you even the association that if you were to have a game of word association, when you think of FAI, what do you think? Mm. You tell me when the words FAI come to mind. Like if I said to you, Jay, what instantly comes to your mind?
GAA?
Yeah.
Lots of things.
I couldn't
you know, say.
It's everything. Mm. It's you know, it's the same with a lot of sport. Whereas when people think of FAI, they think John Delaney, they think of, or the mess it was before, and it has been pointed out by even people who'd be critical of him now, that he actually at a time was what the association probably needed in terms of the mayhem of the previous. You know, there's leaders for situations.
He was
the
broker in Saipan, and he was seen as the breath of fresh air when he took over. And I don't think anyone say that maybe domestically in terms of the League of Ireland, people would feel there would be general consensus that has not thrived under his stewardship, but other areas have. Mm. But the point we're probably making is 14 years is a long stay. It's a long time there. And even moving aside to take up an executive vice president, I just don't think that really cuts for a lot of people away from the football community, as it's called, the football family, isn't that what it's referred to? So. Wednesday will tell a lot, obviously.
It will. Bernard O'Byrne, by the way, denies any wrongdoing in any of his dealings in the FAI and beyond. We should stress that point. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned GAA. Mick Foley's writing about rural depopulation in the Sunday Times. Very interesting piece, this. There was a congress of sorts, or a meeting of sorts, last weekend to discuss this problem. It's part of a wider issue, not just in Ireland, but globally. We are all flocking to cities and towns, and in a sport like GAA, that is going to obviously be detrimental. Some of the figures are really standout, aren't they?
Kerry, this is an ongoing problem in Kerry, and those statistics that Michael reveals, the 13 clubs in East Kerry region around Killarney recorded 1,000 children between under 9 and under 12, but by comparison, the 9 clubs that make up the South Kerry district have just 307, and rural depopulation in the GAA follows rural depopulation generally in society, and it's a societal problem as much as the GAA's problem. GAA, obviously, the bedrock was strong rural clubs and communities, but just the erosion of population there is having an effect where it's just inevitable that so many more clubs are going to have to merge over the next 10 to 20 years. And he mentions Mayo, Kerry and Donegal as three of the counties in the piece. Ironically, at county level, they are probably three counties that have positioned themselves very, very well for a very strong next decade in terms of the players that they have been able to produce. But it is a big problem when, by comparison, when you take Dublin, how many clubs could be in Ballyboden and St Enda's, for instance? There could, you know, you could divide that into possibly three clubs. Kilmacud, Croke's the same. You could divide that. It's not going to happen because they like strength in numbers.
Within even some of those counties, like I think Paul Galvin wrote about it in the Sunday Times about Kerry, about how there is a need for maybe more clubs in Tralee and Killarney.
That's what's really striking about Michael Foley's piece here. So he gives stats like at minor level in Kerry. At minor level, 20% of clubs in Kerry at minor level can't even field a 15-a-side team. 30% can't field a team at under 16 level. Gives an example. The population of Valentia Island, for instance, that's halved in a decade. So that's what the GAA are trying to deal with. And yet the irony, as you said, Ciarán, is that in Killarney and Tralee, there's a talk that we need more clubs almost because there's just an increase in numbers. And there's the O'More Rising report, which was published last year. So Laois GAA reported that up to 10 clubs out of 47 were fearing they might have to fold in the coming decade. So 10 of clubs of 47 reckon they might have to fold in the coming decade. And yet in the very same report, the numbers converging on Port Laois means that there's now the need for a second club.
There is a second club on the outskirts of Port Laois, but is essentially one of the few one club towns, if you like to go. There is a second club there, but they don't produce as much. Maybe Port Laois are a giant club in terms of a provincial town. But Castleknock branched off from St Bridget's, effectively Castleknock, Blanchardstown area. St Bridget's their hinterland, and they're a hugely successful club now. It just shows you the success of a new club in an area like Castleknock. Obviously hard for Bridget's to let go and watch it happen. They obviously want to mind their own patch in that regard. But Castleknock got to a Dublin semi-final a couple of years back.
And built a new clubhouse recently, and it's great.
Yeah, and they've produced Kieran Kilkenny and among many others in the future. So the success of Castleknock just shows, well, what detriment in the area. Bridget's are still a very, very strong senior club in Dublin, huge facilities there on the in Blanchardstown. So
that's fine. It's Valentia Island we're worried
about.
It is
Valentia, yeah. And Valentia brought a motion this year to Congress appealing for some of their under 17 players back as a one team club, and that was knocked back. So they are struggling to field the team irrespective. I think they had a 48 or a 52 year old still playing with them, and actually Tim Murphy mentions in Michael's piece that they had a trainer who was willing to stand in goals for them but couldn't because of parish rule. The GAA, the bedrock of it is obviously...
Well, that's what one of the news lines in the piece is, that he's saying that the parish rule has to be...
But parish rule has its effects.
What is parish rule?
Its advantages. It's basically within a parish, a club has first claim and really only claim to a player that lives within the boundaries of that parish. And in many areas, it's strictly observed. Obviously not in a town, because a town is one parish, and you can, if there's a couple of clubs there, they can move in between. But parish rule is restricting, is now restrictive to smaller clubs. While it's there to protect them, and there's good reasons for it, in that their best players in a small club don't just leave to go to a bigger club for more success. The other side of that is that nobody is able to move in to help them and support them and to fill out their numbers in that regard. So it probably will have to be looked at in some rural areas, that the flow into rural clubs rather than out is allowed.
Mm.
And I think that's probably what he's getting at.
But inevitably, like, these clubs all have a history, right? And you want to try and maintain that as much as possible. But, like, I mean, other sports, it's quite common that you're going to have them gravitate. You're going to have probably more amalgamations and mergers. Like, you have that as is. Like, even what surprised me in your talking about it, like, how in Kerry there's that contrast. I mean, you're a Meath man, Cullum, and, like, obviously in places like, you know, Rathoath and Aspern, it's just spiraled those areas. Whereas I interviewed Michal Brody, the chairperson of the CPA, during the week, and he's from Oldcastle, like, just in the northwest.
He's actually further out, yeah.
And he's making the point that like, in their local school, there's only two boys in one of the local primary classes, you know, like, whereas, you know, what they had a team that did well at Fela because there were seven boys, so that was good, and, you know, they're playing the game and they're bouncing off each other. But and I think the club that they have to merge with underage had nobody in the no boy in the local primary in the new intake there. So as you said outside, like, rural depopulation is a fact of
the world.
Of the world. And, you know, but can more be done for it? Because I thought there's a very good, like, obviously this is triggered by that there was a conference held up in Garvahy by Mark Conway. You know, for some people might remember him, and I suppose some of the skepticism of the GPA, but, you know, some of the work that he has done with Club Tyrone, and
he also invites. I mean, he had a sponsorship seminar which a couple of years back, which invited anyone from any club or county to come up to Garvahy.
Like, they're very. He's very
share
open
ideas. And so he's very, very good in that respect. He had a Brexit night to bring people in. Peter Quinn spoke at it, where the impact of Brexit on the GAA. So he comes up with all these innovative ideas in Garvahy.
Exactly.
And this is obviously this was based on rural challenges for GAA clubs. And It seems a lot has come out of it.
It does, yes. Yeah. So, I mean, look, Tim Murphy travelled up from Kerry to partake. It seems clubs from all over the country partook.
I mean, Pat Spillane has been quite. That's something that he's very passionate about, because, like, you know,
he's chairman of the.
What they're having to do. And, you know, but just Conway gave the example of Loch McCrory, which was this area that the club has actually been new. How it's transformed the community, and like it struck me actually, just the power of like, he's making the point even that, let's say, when you had that tragedy like in Cookstown, that it was one of the galvanising forces at the time in the community was the local GAA club, and like it was brought home to me when I was, like, I suppose I come from a suburb in Cork, and the GAA wouldn't have been as over pervasive in the community, because as you said, like, it's when the more urban you get, and I would have been living in Dublin, but when Cormac McInallen died, and to see the way the English club rallied, it was just an education in the power of the GAA. I know it was the whole GAA community nationally, and the Tyrone and the likes of Mark chipping in, but particularly the local community. It just brought home, and unfortunately I've been going to more funerals through the years, but you see what, particularly in an area, like, even I'm thinking of where I'm living now, and I've written this before, people wouldn't even, when they'd ask where I lived, it was very hard to tell them, but it was basically Ballyea.
See,
Kieran is always stronger.
But lads, the point is not that GAA clubs have lost their power within communities. Mm-hmm. The point is that communities are disappearing. Mm-hmm. GAA clubs are doing fine in the communities. Like, look at this stat from, of the 2016 Mayo minor team. This was Liam Moffat. He was saying, of the 2016 Mayo minor team, 86% of those players left the county. It's always been the way in Mayo, either for work or education. One time you did have Bord na Mona, ESB and other industries, but there's nothing like that now. And I don't know what the GAA can do.
But it follows with the post offices have vanished. The Garda stations have vanished. The schools, pupils are being moved further away to amalgamate schools. It is a societal thing.
It's totally,
it's
going to affect the GAA massively, but it's all very well.
And it's something that the previous Director General, Pádraig Duffy, regularly highlighted in his annual report, that it was the biggest issue facing the GAA, away from all the all of what we like to make bigger deals of, he was consistently saying that this was the biggest challenge that GAA are going to have in the next decade. And
they are trying, in fairness, they've started a new online tool that's been used by the GAA, the Central Statistics Office, Department of Education. It allows clubs and counties to register numbers and upload a load of data. There's a pilot scheme in Kerry, Tyrone, Westmeath, Roscommon. They're hoping to roll out the service everywhere next year. And Colm Cummins, who's with the GAA, is quoted as saying it's the first step. It'll give clubs and counties hard data. And look, that a first step is very admirable, but the hard data.
But it's only just collating statistics that are there anyway.
Does it put
boots in the ground? It won't, and it probably can't. And clubs are going to suffer.
Yeah.
In what they have known for many, many years as single entities, probably is not going to happen. And that's as I said at the outset, it's a societal thing. Unless the parish rule is relaxed one direction that allows players from towns to go out to country clubs. Mm. And that'd be a big thing for town clubs too, who would like to protect their own. Big and all as they are, they still like to protect their own.
Yeah. Unless over the next 10, 20, 30 years we're all able to work from home more and people want to get out and live back in small communities again and they're able to do
Valencia,
that.
Valencia actually have a scheme to that effect where they linked up with a company in Kildare who were agreeable to allowing a technology company in Kildare agreeable to allowing their employees to work from Valencia if they wanted to move down for a different quality of life. Mm. And a number of them took up that offer.
No doubt. Yeah.
And are now based down in Kerry working for a company out of Kildare. Mm. So from that point of view, it is happening. Maybe it will continue in that vein, but it's still an uphill struggle.
No, it sure is. Could you do your job living in the country?
Do regular, yeah. We can do it.
That's how I ended up there. You could work from remote, but not everyone has that luxury. But it's clubs that are the amount of players who are commuting, or like Micheál Brody talked about in his own time when he was living in Dublin and that commute, That is what has kept a lot of, even Mullinlack, the amount of players that are away.
Came from England to play.
But it's just like Liam made the point about the amount of Mayo players that were playing in the Dublin County Final, and involved, and that they're not coming back. Their children are going to be in the Dublin area. So it said that as much as the GAA has been the clue, it's more than the GAA. Whether the GAA makes more representation, to government. I mean, they were talking about how difficult it is to get, planning permission in some rural areas. That's what it can do. But what it has to, the games have to be provided to people who want to play them. It's just that you're going to probably just see more amalgamations. And I see it in Clare where some clubs that are amalgamating by coming together, they're far more competitive. Fecal. Have had to amalgamate, that would be the club of Lucknan and Tommy Guilfoyle, and they've been very competitive at under 21 level by amalgamating with the local club, whereas by themselves they might only be mid-cut playing in the B Championship. So there can be a potential upside if it's handled right, but it's an issue that's going to, it was a worthy conference, to come.
Yeah, it's a great idea. You mentioned Micheál Brody there. He's in the Sunday Independent with Dermot Crowe. You wanted to talk about that? You were chatting to him during the week?
What's interesting about it is because the CPA was, my intro was, they haven't gone away, because they were formed 2.5 years ago, and you'd have to ask what's really happened. But it seems like things could be on the verge of happening, in that the GAA and particularly President John Horan and Central Council are about to basically establish a committee to look at, I suppose, fixing the fixtures as such, or reviewing inter-county championship structures. It's just a case of what will be the makeup of that committee. The CPA have been told that they'll have representation on it, I suppose. It'll just be interesting as to, will it be external, people with a certain expertise that will be looking at, would be off the GAA, but not with, let's say, an administrator, will the makeup, will there be, let's say, a former county manager who can speak would have that perspective going into it, or will it be just, a provincial council chairman, or the makeup of the committee will be of interest? But there seems to be a realisation, and Brody referenced the boat in the piece with Dermot Crowe today in the Sindo, and the interview I had with him during the week, that he thinks that John Horan and Tom Ryan understand both the significance of this, and then there's an urgency to this as well, because he's making the point that it's increasingly happening where, you know, they're getting letters from, you know, 28-year-olds who are just about to get engaged and saying, look, I need to know what's happening now because I'm not going to be playing the game at 30. There's a lot of people. It's grand to say, oh, this will be drip, drip, drip. How many players will we lose? Because, you know, the reference, the amount of turnover, 75% turnover from 19 to 24-year-olds, and a lot of it is because they don't have a proper program of games, and a lot of that is because of just how the competitions inter-county, like you have in their own right competitions, like the Munster Hurling Championship has been magnificent. The Super 8s has a case for it then in July. But what it has is squeezed out. Like, obviously, the Cork motion was big news during the week. And, like, up until 2 years ago, although it was far from ideal, there were Cork Championship matches played in months like June and July. That is impossible now because of the format.
I probably have said this before, but the fixtures issue in the GAA is like the health service. The more you throw at it, the bigger the problems seem to increase.
Yeah, totally agree.
I mean, when you look at the last few years, Super 8s have been added. The Munster and Leinster round robins have been added. It's almost like putting petrol on the fire to increase the number of inter-county games. And when you restructure all the other hurling competitions, there's about 28 more inter-county games within a more condensed period of time. And while that has given time further out in September and on, obviously into October, it's created a window of opportunity for a lot of counties. There just isn't room for any inter-county or any club fixtures between May and June. Now, I do note that Kilkenny are going to play a round of club fixtures, championship matches, after they play Carlow in the first match in Leinster on a Tuesday and a Wednesday night, midweek early. Mm-hmm. So that's a development from their point of view, because they didn't play any through those months. But they have a 2 week break or a 3 week break, the way it falls them. So they're putting in club fixtures. Mm-hmm. They were really annoyed last year. The clubs in Kilkenny were really annoyed that they didn't get to. But the committee you're talking about that's going to look at this from a broad brush view, they're going to have to make some very, very hard decisions, because the time is not there to cater for everyone as it is. You cannot fit it all together. Mm. You have dual counties, dual clubs. There's just too much going on. You're trying to protect the third level competitions. Provinces will want to keep the preliminary pre-season competitions as a run-in to stop teams from playing challenges and just to regulate it a little bit at that time of year. There's just too much going on. And by adding all those games with Super 8s, and they've just increased, the problems have increased. Mm. So unless some really hard decisions about competitions are, and the structure and the order of them are made, then it's really back to the health service. You're only...
I find that here on the show, even anytime we try to do a 20, 30 minute discussion on this subject, about 20 minutes in, I start waving the white flag.
But the only thing is...
Because there is... It's
just, there's about 18 things we haven't thought of.
Yeah.
Everybody also has a very different viewpoint of what the GAA is. Like, I think that is the starting point. They do need to lay down what is the GAA in the 21st century, what are the priorities? Because, you know, Joe Brawley talks about the importance of the club, and he sees it as a community-based thing above all else, and that's a very strong argument, and that should, you know, take precedence over the county scene. You know, he'd argue it should be a two-month festival of football, the county scene, and the rest of it should be club. That's his vision of the GAA. I guarantee you we could talk to 20 other people, and they'd have a different vision of the GAA.
But I think that's a vision issue, and that is...
One man's vision, and it's pretty close to the ideals. How often do you hear that the club is the center of it? But it's not really.
No, it's not.
Inter-county is the shop window.
But they are symbiotic, because the best recruiting policy for the clubs to go down is let's say the county being competitive or having a visibility or being relevant. Mm-hmm. And I know you can throw up and be exasperated, and that's how it has led to where we are. But as Brody made the point, like with a bit of imagination, this can happen. Like, I mean, you'll have to, some competitions will have to be, as he said, you're looking to benefit club, county players, because there is sometimes in some of the assumptions people make that the county player has to play for every game for everybody, and that's flogging them. You know, they're not going to be playing at 27, 28 if they're expected to. Like, what you're basically saying is a club player can only have half the programme that a county player does. No, like, there has to be an acceptance that the county player isn't going to be able to play, let's say, in every game for the club. He should be able to play every championship game for the club. And I suppose, you know, Cork touched on that. But with a bit of imagination, as Brody said, like, let's say you're looking, like, I often think, like, let's say if you had it, let's say January and most of February is just left to the colleges.
Do you know, I just can't, like, go down this route. We're not doing this because
But Brody made the point, like, and I'd agree. Like, you could go, there's cases for even if you, with a bit of planning,
yeah,
you could have midweek games which could free up players to play. You could play a midweek game with your county.
Okay,
but for midweek
games aren't fair.
For midweek games,
players.
Yeah,
but if it was one game.
I can't play a midweek game.
No, you're saying that, but these guys get to train in. Like, yeah, but if you had one game where you knew 6 months out that, let's say, Sligo Carlow, as he said, like, let's just say, let's say in a tier two, and you knew 6 months in advance that, you know, you might need. Because, look, players do it constantly to get out for camp.
For midweek games, you need lights.
For
midweek games you need lights. To put lights into a lot more clubs you need money.
Wait, but that's clubs. But we're talking about
to
county
get money,
club
you need
games.
An intercounty game to generate.
No, but the floodlight games at intercounty. Every county, virtually every county has a county.
Oh, I thought you were talking about club games.
You want county matches midweek.
Just one, like, if you're talking about
sure,
it,
too. But there's been resistance to that, Kieran.
There has been resistance,
has
and
been
that's the whole point.
To Friday
there has,
and,
there, like, there was a big one there. The GPA came up with Carlow and Laois on a Friday night. Was it a qualifier?
And there's the issue of compensation for players having.
But if it
to
was
take
a one
day
game,
off.
Well, then maybe you do because.
But they weren't in agreement, and I don't see them being in agreement
midweek. The GPA?
No, I don't see players or unless they are compensated. And when the issue of compensation comes up, then you're in a different sphere then. So. Mm.
Straight away, Shannon's bright idea is shot down. But that's just one small example, and it's not a crazy idea at all. But you just see immediately.
Like you were saying, that because
for every solution, someone will come up with another problem.
But that relates to
fixtures, and that relates to conversations that we have probably had here before about it. Where you just go around, and unless really hard decisions about the structure of the championship and league is taken, where less games are taken, more games are taken off the table rather than added to, and
or
unless intercounty, unless it's scaled down, the intercounty.
I still think there's
going to
exist. Exactly. Unless intercounty is scaled down, then frankly, club and county, it's not compatible.
And if intercounty is scaled down, there will be financial repercussions for clubs. That's a fact. That, you know, there's a large scale infrastructural problem for the GAA coming down the tracks, in that they are going to need, you know, better facilities right across. And I know we've been talking about rural population, but that's the playing numbers are still there at entry level for kids. And with the merger of the ladies Gaelic football and Camogie, there's going to be more bodies around clubs. Mm. Where do they put them? How do they fund that? And those revenue streams. And it's an unpalatable thing to say in the club county divide, but money is going to be required, and where does it come from? And if it's an intercounty scale, then it shouldn't be the priority. I know that, but it is.
It's a reality.
It is a reality. Yeah.
Yeah. Final thoughts. You told me you were not going to drag us down a championship restructuring thing. If anyone still was listening on News Talk, I should say.
Well, I think there was, like, Michal Clifford has a good. I think with a bit of imagination, you could have a system that allows for all parties being happy. Mm-hmm. Like, Michal Clifford has a good piece about how close the games in the league tend to be compared to the championship. You know, it is screaming out for. I've written this extensively myself, where you flip the league to you know, you have the provincial. You nearly have a provincial league in months like February or March, and then you have championship, and you only need 12, 13 weeks for inter-county. For, you know, we're a county team, like, And, you know, you get rid of the unnecessary, the pre-season competitions. And there can be, if you manage it right, you have to decide whether it's going to be split club county or can you stagger games. Because you take, in the rugby, Joe Schmidt had, let you take Munster and Leinster, game six of the European Cup. 2 weeks later, they're in Six Nations. So Joe Schmidt has only 2 weeks. Now, I know he has them every day, but like, because what you have now at the moment with clubs at this...
Can I interrupt for a moment there? Yeah. Just for a moment. I just think that is verging on irrelevant. Those are professional players.
No, but
Joe Schmidt...
No, but what you have at the moment... Wait a second.
No, hang on. Joe Schmidt knows they've been trained properly, that they've got the best S&C, that they're being looked after, that their minutes are being moderated to the nth degree, mm-hmm. that he has a big say in how much they're doing, their workload, what they're working on. He has regular meetings with them. Okay, that is completely different to a county manager sitting here and seeing all his players at different clubs, different quality coaches, different quality S&C, different demands. And some of them will arrive in battered. Some of them will arrive in undercooked. Then your two-week lead-in is an absolute nightmare. For Joe Schmidt, it's a very different situation. You have to concede that. There's no comparison with maybe 12 clubs across the county.
But at the moment,
Johan van Graan with a few Munster and Leinster players. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's a
no,
massive.
No, no,
difference.
Like, this
week or in over the next few weeks, intercounty players will play games with their clubs, but midweek they will train with the counties. By and large, they won't all be.
Some exceptions, yeah.
Dublin being an exception, there in the last mm-hmm. couple of years, Dublin have taken 4 or 5 weeks off because they can. Yeah. They're going to breeze through a Leinster Championship mm-hmm. and they're seeking to a different peak. Whereas other counties in Leinster are required on May 12 or May whenever to go, so they need some of these weeks to
prepare. Like, the reality is, a lot of them are going to be with their clubs at the moment too, so the damage is being done of sorts. But like, so it's a case of whether you do you decide that you split that the first 6 months are with the county and then it's with the club, or do you stagger it in? Like, you take Kilkenny, like you're on about it there, but Cody has let them off to the club mm. in between, you know, particularly under the old format it was. So look, that's the whole point. But what we want to stop is that we're not talking about this again in 3 to 5 years' time, and it is having dropouts, so that it seems like they're about to grasp the nettle, and that this committee has been established, and that we'll get. Because at the moment, as much as, let's say, can't wait for the Munster Hurling Championship kick-off in a few weeks' time, but there are club players and there's a alienation within the clubs at the moment that, you know, it's summer, it's June and we're not playing.
I know, it's dreadful. Look, I think we're all agreed the problem is horrific and you can totally understand mm-hmm. dropout. It's mm-hmm. one of the reasons I left GAA myself. It's just mm-hmm. insanity, not knowing when games are on or what the season is, as opposed to football or whatever sport you're playing. I think we're still here in 5 years.
Right.
I think there'll be good ideas. I think there'll be strong ideas.
I agree. I think we'll be 5 years. I think that the hardest decisions, no matter which, what decision you make, and I think there'll be a kickback somewhere. And
it's
that's like, always be
the... Compared to a Rubik's Cube, you move one thing, it has a kickback. Yeah,
I don't think the hardest decisions that have to be made will be made, and that is to reduce the number of intercounty games. Mm. And it won't be done... for probably financial reasons, although to be fair to the GAA, they took out replays by and large yep. with the addition mm-hmm. of extra time. There's not as many replays. They were big money spinners. So, you know, you cannot say that it is all about revenue, but I think there's consciousness about the intercounty window mm. being big enough for others to come into via a different route rather than a club.
Colin, would you like to see the intercounty season reduced? When you think to the year just gone where the sport disappeared from the national consciousness in a way across September when it used to have it, was that good for the game?
I think it's something you could get used to. I think September, on difficult as it was for in that respect, I think it's something to get used to. I think it probably has to be done to allow... Mm. to allow more time for clubs to finish, you know, not have blitzes in October yeah. like they had in Donegal 1 year, because obviously the players were...
And it led to Carl Lacey was never
yeah,
really right after that.
Four games in 24 days.
But the only thing is... Like,
yeah, so that's a sacrifice that had to be made. It's yeah. not the right word, sacrifice, mm-hmm. but that's a hard decision that was taken, basically taking replays off. So a lot has been done mm. to measure this up in a lot better way. And it is better now, even though you would say it's not. It is actually better because now a lot of clubs do actually know within when we might be playing. It's just that there's this large gap from April to July for most clubs that is the issue. And unless they can find windows in between there, which intercounty managers won't want.
No.
So the games are coming. For me, the intercounty games are probably coming too thick and fast. Some great games. I mean, everybody enjoys the intercounty games, regardless of what they say they do, of course.
Yeah.
The league, you know, you're wondering when did Tipperary play Clare and the hurling, and you know, so the games come so thick and fast, they don't really breathe.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. They get lost very quickly. It's on to the next one. I'll give you a final word, seeing as you dragged us down.
You took us down this route.
No, yeah. Well, it's like it was, Dermot was talking about the CPA. Like it is one of those ones where they want to be redundant in the next year. And if something doesn't change, they are essentially redundant. But what they want to be is redundant, having something haven't changed. And I still just think that that as you said, like we can't be having these conversations in 5 years' time. You'd be pessimistic, but I just think that it can be worked out. Like that's a valid point what you're talking about. And as you said, I've worked with various teams and I've seen some counties be too honest to their own fault in club players or county players being flogged. Like even I'm looking at in Clare at the moment, which is a dual county, and there's players who are dual, and they're expected to play hurling one day, football the next day. Now, there's good management by certain clubs, but a young fella could be exploited to play a Saturday, Sunday, and then he's a county man. And I think it does. And April, we're talking about this because it's April, and it's a fudge, right? Or it's no man's land, and so that we won't be talking about this, Joe, in a few years' time. We hope that there's that committee that will talk about it, because there is that disgruntlement. And as much as there's some great competitions, some competitions you wonder are past their set. Like, I don't know if people are really looking forward to a lot of the football provincial championships the way that they maybe would have in previous years. So, we've spoken about it long enough. Let's hopefully we won't be talking about it in a few years' time, but we might be.
Mm. You have the Paul Kimmage piece open there, Colm.
Yes, my name is Aileby. I have been kicked out of Tully United for 2 years now. It's a story about the Rafter family from County Clare, who are in dispute with their local soccer club over allegations of verbal abuse from a coach that were investigated. And the point and the story, as Paul threads it, is that it wasn't investigated properly and it didn't follow guidelines and procedures. And it's probably quite similar to a piece that he did, was it last year or the year before, Athenry GA Club. So it is very, very similar. It goes through the whole process step by step, very, very detailed. I think for me, the crunch is the last few paragraphs, because you look at it and you say, well, there's a lot in that. And you say, well, what's it about? Because you sort of have to live these cases and try and put yourself and to follow them. And a lot of people may not be familiar with the processes and some of the terms and all of that. But look, he obviously sets it out very, very well. And in the last, say, six or seven paragraphs, he gets to it from my point of view, but you're not listening right, because some people may trail off this. They may trail off this, but you're not listening right. You stopped reading after the second paragraph. You thought, why are they publishing this? A coach swore at some kids. It happens all over the country. Why this coach? Why this club? What's the big deal? The big deal is that kids matter. What we say to them matters. What they say to us matters. The kid, in other words, the kid at the center of this, the kid matters. His sister Aileby matters. Their parents matter. And he also says they're there to protect the kids, but they're there to protect the guidelines he's talking about here. They're there to protect the coach and Dennis Corrie too, who is the children's welfare officer, who was involved in investigating this at the outset. So it's quite detailed. It reaches a conclusion in that guidelines weren't followed as per instruction, but it's left open. You wonder why this matter? And in reading it, I would have thought straight away, why wasn't it sorted out at the very outset? It looked to me in reading this now, as I say, I haven't fully grasped it, but it looked to me that it was something that could have been sorted out at the outset with an understanding. And it looked like it probably could have been at one stage, but it developed into written complaints and got tangled up into the process. And Paul's point probably is that the processes aren't really fit for purpose.
Mm. What struck you about it, Ciarán?
Well, I would, first of all, recommend people read it, because, you know, sometimes you're going like, what? Like, someone's going like Tulla United, like, who are they? You know, it's not box office baby.
No, that's
like
the glamour of the big name.
But the only thing is, like, Paul can carry the story, and we've spoken about it before, like a lot of good stories, and several of the ones that he's done in the of this type, you know, there's the universal in the local, yes, like in the local, and like you can totally relate to it. I can relate to it. I coach underage soccer. I actually have done a lot of this. Is about child protection and safeguarding. I actually did my safeguarding course. It was run by the FAI, but it was at the grounds of Tulla United, and I was actually very impressed by both in that they actually had quite a lot of young players and coaches themselves who were taking the course. So it seemed a vibrant club, a progressive club. But what Paul is highlighting here is, like, as he says, and Colm quoted it there at the outro, the child, everything should be child-centred in the coaching. And, you know, that like, you're looking at this and you're saying, like, that the one thing that struck me was that, like, they had a concern. This kid did not want to go to the ground because of some of the communication with the coach. Now, how it spiraled after that it had to be a written complaint. Like, I mean, I coach myself, and one of the things, I have meetings with parents at the start of a season, and you'd say, like, oh, you know, if there's something, if there's an issue, just even in the communication, a young fella might have maybe been left out of. Didn't get enough even kicks at the goal at a training session at a night, or if there's something, come to us, or I have a liaison manager to let us know. That the last thing you want to be is the last coach that kid has in that sport. And how you had this kid did not want to go there because of the communication with the coach, and they were talking about game time and not getting on. And I do find, like, this, and why this article will resonate with people, because this dilemma for both coaches, parents, the kids themselves, like, there are coaches, I don't know if it was applicable in this case, but that's how the kid interpreted it, was that there was no place for someone who wasn't going to really help them win, or, it, you know, that they were, that the kid felt they were nearly responsible for the defeat of the team. Like, this is not, and some coaches can feel that they're coaching Real Madrid. Like, I don't know if that was the case here, but the point is, like, you know, they talk about the best coaches is how you make them feel. This coach, or this player, did not felt they wanted to give up. They did not want to go what's supposed to be an activity. And, like, how the club, I was surprised that it went to the notion of, like, that this has to, because sometimes you give a heads up just to a coach, hey, listen, this is, like, I would do it with my own kids or playing with other coaches, and you might just say, have a little thing about just to the kid, but you want it to work for the coach and that they're open to that. How it spiraled into complaints, and then they were asked to give the complaint, and then they got criticism, according to this, is that they didn't point out what was good with the club, and it just absolutely spiraled. And and sometimes one thing struck me, like, is that sometimes, and it's I'd be conscious of, you know, before a child goes into a program, is what is the ethos of this club like, and is it where I want to have my children? And there's a case for where, like, well, maybe just this club wasn't the fit for you. No, ideally, and of course they shouldn't have to leave, but it's
there's probably a balance to be struck between being competitive and giving everyone a fair shake. And I would have found that, being involved with a team as well, you'd be so conscious of those players behind you. And what sort of game time can we give while trying to maintain a competitive edge? Because at the end of the day, kids playing games like adults, they want to win as well. And it's to strike that balance between giving the game time and being competitive. And that's, again, that's the reality of it.
Yeah.
They want to win.
I know. I look back at my own underage career, and without naming teams or anybody, anything like that, like, it's mad to think, you know, I do remember, like, even under 11s, unused substitutes were unused at times, you know, and you think back now, and the thing is, as a 10, 11-year-old, we bloody wanted to win as well. Yeah. And there is that balance. Kids definitely want to win as well.
And but sometimes the kids want to win more than the coaches.
Sometimes.
But also the coaches. To. There are coaches
I think that area. I think that has improved in
Irish
sport.
But it's still an issue. There was a very good piece by, was it Seamus Colin, or sorry, Dave Colin, will play with Cork City, got the winning goal in the FA Cup in 98. So it was Derek Collin was a very good soccer player, but his father would have been on the 73 Cork team, and how he was one of his mentors, and Joe Kavanagh would have done a couple of good pieces in the lead up to, was it playing Schlockneil in the semi-final last year, about the Nemo ethos. Yeah. And Derek Collin was on about this frustration, I wanted to win, and he said, well, Johnny's been going to training every session as well. Mm. Like, he's entitled to a game as well. And Nemo are willing to actually, for the irony for them, what they find is that they're about winning when it really counts at 17, 18. Yeah. And they've had so many late developers. And what the late developer is the early lever if you don't have the right ethos. And it's as you said, it's a difficult balance to get for coaches. But whatever, the one thing I would say is whatever they get about playing time, like the less you play them, the more you coach them, the more you make them feel involved in the session. And that kid, that's how they interpret it. And that's a reality. And it seems to be that it just ended up being this absolutely, everything had to be, and then as Paul alludes to, that there wasn't a consistency in certain things being documented, and like that there just didn't seem to be an actual, like I would like to think that in any club I'm involved with, that you'd have that the coach would be receptive to mea culpa, and trying to established, because coaches can do a lot right and there can be an outlier incident, and but it should be with the view of this will make the program better or the coach better and everything better. And unfortunately, what's very sad is that as the headline goes, you know, Alva and Kate, her brother, the kid is out.
Yeah, but it is for sure worth reading and worth giving time to, and certainly if you read the last few paragraphs, that really gets to it. The whole theme of it, and why it was important to go through all the stages, because you could probably replicate the genesis of this story in many, many clubs across many, many codes. This is not just unique to soccer; it is probably there.
Like last year's one was similar with hurling, wasn't it?
Hurling, yeah.
Well, put it this way: I suspect he can look forward to lots of correspondence from lots of different people all around the country over the next two.
Well, that's
weeks.
How that article obviously
of course,
came about.
Of course, you know, yeah. See that, yeah, and yeah. Someone else. That's going to prompt someone else. So obviously, the Sunday Independent have to be conscious not to work these in too often either.
Yeah.
Mm. But this was obviously a case that struck a chord, because, you know, I think the handwritten letter to John Delaney that Ailibhe Rafter sent age 12, stating the case of her brother, and that probably struck a chord.
Yeah. It should be said that we don't hear from the coach in this piece. And we hear from Dennis Corrie, who has an exchange with Paul Kimmage towards the end, and certainly they are of the opinion that things were handled in a correct manner, which obviously the parents of the child at the centre of the case dispute. So as Paul says at one stage at the end, before he gets to the summary that you read out, Colm, he writes, he said, she said, he said, she said, he said, she said, and that is the time.
That is
he's
it.
Always,
that is
that's,
it. It's,
that's why they're so difficult to get to the root cause.
Conflicting views to find judgment in all of these cases, and obviously there's honourable people within this club, and there's a family earnestly telling their story.
Yeah.
And to come down in judgment either way, unless you're really, really living the case and unless you're there.
No, it's
really
not our place to do that.
No,
it's not our place to do that. But I think you can, it's definitely not our place to do that, and we're not doing that. But you definitely can say it is such a pity when what seems like a relatively minor incident in the context of where it's arrived at now takes up several years of their life.
That would have struck you from the outset and reading the piece. You say, just can you get like come back here and
stress of it, and just
bring it back to here and let's see.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's page 2 and 3. It's well worth a read. It's very hard to get everything across because it's very detailed. But I'm sure you'll check it out online or in the paper today over the next couple of days. There's a profile piece of Gary Keegan before we finish up in the Masters that is in the Sunday Times. He's somebody who's been mentioned, actually, I presume. I don't, well, I'm not going to presume anything, but he has been, he's a name which has been floating around as a potential CEO of the FAI. Mm. And here he is, there's a profile piece, Dennis Walsh is writing about Gary Keegan. There's no real quotes from Keegan, it's very much a profile
piece. It's a profile.
He keeps a low...
he does, I mean...
There's a picture of him here, and when you read the piece and then you reflect on... he should have a Superman cape on him, because it seems, from reading this, and it brings it all together, is he is the man with the Midas touch. Even Jim Gavin gives testimony to him at the very outset.
A profound impact on Dublin GAA.
Profound impact. So he has been working away in the background. He was obviously a couple of years with the Cork Hurlers, and they were successful.
They made quite a leap when you consider where they were in 2016.
You know, there's testimony from Luke O'Farrell as to how he helped to change his game and brought him renewed focus and all of that. And he remembers going for a couple of balls, actually. He says that a couple of balls that he went against Waterford. I did a shocking thing with the first two balls, but I remember I got an important point towards the end of that. I knew I wouldn't have got it if it wasn't for him. Mm. So that's pretty strong testimony.
Where people would have first heard of Gary Keegan would have been the work he did with the Boxers. In 2003, he wrote the first high-performance plan, and then for the next 5-6 years, he put that in place, and the results were obvious. And that's where suddenly Gary Keegan's name, from a public point of view, where we first kind of heard of him.
Then with the Institute, where the Institute has come on since, because they saw what he did with the Boxers. So, and, you know, going back to what we were saying earlier, just about how Irish sport, both its governance, but also just the whole high performancers. Gary likes to talk about, he uses that term space a lot, but I mean, he has hugely driven, so he has influenced sports from rowing to Paralympic sport. Even his successor with the Institute, Liam Harbison, would have dealt with him quite a lot. They were among the first sports to grasp what the Institute was planning.
Is Gary the origin of the use of the word peace in interviews?
Yeah, he uses it so often. So, I counted it 23 times.
You listen to interviews now, and you hear the word peace. The hunger piece.
Or the humility piece.
Skills piece and all these pieces.
And space.
I'll tell you what, to him.
But what he's done with that piece is...
Down in my estimation.
But no, he's a very good operator, and it's a good profile because he has gone to ground.
There's a reference to Annalise Murphy and the work he did. So he's...
That was interesting, the Annalise Murphy point. Yeah. Do you want to mention it to people? So he gave some advice.
What probably struck me was the advice he gave. He broke down a year before Rio, but one of the things that struck me, the contact continued. So this is obviously in relation to Annalise Murphy and Rory Fitzpatrick, Sailing's high performance manager. And Keegan supported and challenged them. One of his suggestions was that Fitzpatrick and Murphy should get into the boxing ring, sometimes against each other. Mm. So it was probably to deliver a harder edge against some of her opponents. That's what it was behind, is to deliver a harder edge and maybe to be a bit more ruthless.
Dennis Walsh writes, you have to get used to hurting your opponents. A lot of the fleet would have been Annalise Murphy's friends on shore. She didn't particularly enjoy destroying someone.
So she gets in with the Sailing high-performance manager and boxes him.
Gets used to doing that, Fitzpatrick, by the way, says he is the best sporting intellect of anybody I've come across. And there's a great scene as well of Anthony Daly going to see him in 2013.
Yeah.
Along with, was it Richie Stakelham?
Richie Stakelham, and the sweat came out. The sweat was coming down, Rory. Richie Stakelham's back when they came outside and sat in the car, and it was the intensity, a meeting, that's all it was, taking us apart about our thinking.
Yeah, and they have a quote from Issa Nasewa as well. When he went back to Leinster, they were looking for someone to fill that space in Leinster, and they looked around and they decided Keegan was the man. Nasewa says, once I got the opportunity to sit down with him, it sort of blew my mind. Everything about him screams high performance.
So, Kieran, over to you. Can you get the sweat rolling down his back with your intensity?
Nasewa's been around the block. He's seen his fair share of people, and he's saying Gary Keegan blew his mind.
Mm. Mm. And I think what he's particularly good at is, because the Dublin players, I believe, wouldn't see him a whole lot.
It's more Jim Gavin, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, no, he'll come in occasionally, I believe, but the thing is that it's with the management, and I'd be curious as to know how much he would have worked with, and just how much he was working with Cork. Kingston obviously brought him on. I don't know what it was like with Myler, but He stayed, he's not involved. He stayed for a year, but the job wasn't complete, you know, with Cork. And it's just, it's interesting as to, but he obviously has, I think, still an association with Dublin. But he has gone to ground. I've interviewed him. I did find him, you know, that the intensity, it's from a passion, but he comes from a background like where he would have worked, basically a naval company for delivering haulage, and he in terms of the training as a cadet, basically his training, you're talking about military like precision. I mean, himself and Gavin would be together on that one. Like, I remember him talking about, you know, everything, like if there was a speck of dust, like he was responsible for the kitchen. And he comes from the school of hard knocks, both, you know, in his professional life and then through boxing, but just brings a precision to detail that, I know that's a cliche in itself now, but it particularly, that's what the boxers did. And yet he brought a belief too that we're good enough to do it, you know, he's presented at Croke Park before. Yes, they had to bring in Azor Antia, but like they knew Billy Walsh wasn't world class yet, but that he could be. And between them and what the program that they revamped, and as I said, that's rolled into other programs in Irish sport, which is why it was in the institute. And going back to where we started with, you know, the Tommy Conlon argument about how the FAI would be seen to be just out of kilter with the rest of Irish sport where it's going. You know, I see Kieran Cunningham floating that he'd be because there is a vacancy for the chief executive of the FAI. And I'd say he would also be, because that's high performance FAI, going back to what we're talking about, is a participation sport too. But I think he could... I think he could merge that piece too. So,
as Niall Quinn succinctly put it, he would not go near.
No, he wouldn't go under the circumstances. No, but that's exactly why he's needed. So he's still contributing to Irish sport, even though he's stepped down as director of the institute.
Yes, so he's got his own consultancy firm at the moment, by the way. If you're wondering, Uppercut. So, just to finish off, then there's obviously Masters previews in various pages. It all kicks off on Thursday. McIlroy's a big story, Woods is a big story, you've Dermot Cleese writing about it, you've got Paul McGinley in the Sunday Times previewing it, you've got, David Walsh in the Sunday Times, actually more of a feature on Augusta. They had an amateur event there, a women's amateur event, last night at Augusta, the first time, which is one small step, I suppose, forward for a club which has been very slow in a whole host of areas, not least female members, and when it comes to the area of racial diversity as well. And David Walsh says, golf is joining other sports and dragging itself out of the dark ages, but discrimination against women has not gone away. There can be no hiding place for crude, outdated attitudes, and golf is moving slower than most sports. Karen Crouse, he quotes, says they could extend an invitation to the women's reigning major champions to compete alongside men in the Masters Part 3. I mean, maybe that feels a bit gimmicky to me. I think they should just have a proper professional tournament at Augusta.
But the timing, yeah. And the timing of it.
Yeah, it wasn't ideal. So, like, the women's first major is on the TV at the moment. The ANA Inspiration, the ANA Inspiration. The names of the women's majors, by the way, they need to sort out. They've sold them off to sponsors and they're just terrible names. Mm. They need to do something about that, I think. It's on a Mission Hills at the moment, but... generally, the top six amateurs are invited to play in the majors, and obviously the amateurs were playing at this tournament in Augusta, so four of those opted to not play at Augusta and to play the LPGA event. It is a major. So even the timing of it wasn't ideal. Like, I mean, you're putting this historical event in some respects on the same week as the first major of the year, but it's a small step forward. But I don't think anybody should be getting in too big a hurry to congratulate Augusta on how they're moving with the times, you know? Mm. As Walsh writes at one point, Augusta didn't have a men-only rule, but in its 70-year existence, to the point of bringing in Condoleezza Rice and others, there hadn't been one female member. So
quotes the Roy Keane when a goalkeeper teammate once told him how hard he and his fellow goalkeepers worked in training. We know her. That's a reference to, obviously, do you expect me to pat you on the back for that? Said Keane. Yeah. It's probably what your reference.
A bit of that.
I actually enjoyed Dermot Cleese's nostalgic trip back to the 1989 Masters, which surprised me in that it was his first. I would have thought he might have been travelling there for a few years beforehand, but obviously. Irish papers would only have really started sending when Rafferty even played in that, but the explosion of European winners in the Masters in the 80s, Sandy Lyle and Woosnam,
Faldo won that one, didn't he? 89.
Faldo won 89. And the other thing that jumped out at me was he mentions it's Rory McIlroy's 11th Masters.
Yeah.
Like, was it 2011 he was in a winning position?
Yeah.
So, like, he had only two prior to that. And
he was in a winning position last year. We would have felt going into the last round, too.
Paul McGinley does have an interesting piece. And even hearing him talk after he won the Players' Championship, how he seems to be, I suppose, more selective and disciplined in his thinking. Like, one of the things that struck me as amazing was how he was following social media for comments, and he was watching, was it Ulster Rugby, and you know, there's people who were going to win the Masters, but he's talked about how he was reading up so much on himself, good and bad, and like I think LeBron James actually is an example of someone who around that period of time too admitted that he allowed his brain to be fried and was distracted and allowed it, I suppose, inform, you know, his own self-image of himself, like, if you know, on various things, and he just came to a view of switching off. Now, LeBron doesn't have to worry about it this year because he didn't make the playoffs, but when the playoffs, he actually calls a zero dark 30. He switches off social media and just goes into an area, and that doesn't mean that all he's thinking about is his sport. It's about reading different things and having different activities. But not, in other words, no outside distractions are going to infiltrate my mind and what I think of myself. Whereas, like McGinley references how Brad Faxon's has got him to work about less being concerned about what the critics think. So obviously it got to him a bit before. And I think he spoke at that Players' Championship before too about how he allowed bad defeats affect his mood so much that it was his whole identity was being a golfer, whereas he's been able to separate himself that, and there he's actually been able to play freer as a result. And okay, he had a setback at the match play against Tiger, but it was probably a blip. You know, there has been a serious consistency about him this year. So we always say it, but he's in a strong position going in for this one.
Well, McGinley says it's his best chance he's had for the past 4 or 5 years to complete the Grand Slam. And he was almost businesslike when he won the Players. There was no big celebration. It was almost like a march off, job done, high five, and out he goes. So he's tied fifth last year, but as you said, Colin was in the final group. He missed that eagle put on the second and just seemed to go to pieces. So it was as bad a fifth place finish as you can imagine. Seventh in 2017. He was fourth in 2015.
That form over the last 5 years in the Masters, he's been top 10.
Well, the course is made for him.
Yeah.
You know, from a driving perspective. Loves that big draw. He'll continue to contend there.
Yeah.
It's just whether for some horrible reason he doesn't get it done. I mean, it's happened. Like, you look at Greg Norman's career.
Maybe he should get Yuri Geller.
Well, we can put him in touch with Yuri Geller. No problem. We can do that. McGinley does make an audacious enough point, I suppose. It's not contentious, but if McIlroy was to stop and think about it, you know, if he wins at Augusta and he completes the Grand Slam, suddenly it's him and Saracen and Hogan and Gary Player and Nicholas and Woods, and that is it in the history of this game. And he says it does two things. One, it separates him from every other player of this era. You know, so the arguments about Dustin Johnson or Jordan Spieth or Justin Thomas, who's the best, they just disappear. McIlroy's in a league of his own. And then secondly, he automatically becomes the best ever European player. Even though Faldo's won 6 majors, and that would put McIlroy to 5, because it's the Grand Slam, he's the best European player ever. So that's a lot to think about. You don't want to focus overly on that. It's all he's asked about. It's been the same way for the last three or four years,
irrespective. So until he goes, obviously, and goes and does it, we're still going to be discussing. But I would think, might have said it last year, this feels like his best chance.
Yeah, absolutely agree. The consistency has been, like, you'd almost be shocked if he's not at least in the top 5.
And I think if he wins this, he could add another one, possibly Portrush in the summer.
It's like Mickelson.
I think it will trigger another couple in quick succession. I think it will go like that once he gets past this current block. Because there is a bit of a block there since his last one. And that has to play on his mind. But I do feel when he gets it done, it'll create something else.
I am I mean, it's just a theory and obviously can be blown out of the water, but increasingly, the way he played last year in the final round where he was nervous from the first tee and put his first tee shot away right and then his shoulders dropped when he missed the second on the eagle putt. I do wonder if McIlroy, with the Masters, is going to have to almost win this thing on a Saturday and play virtuoso golf and be 6, 7, 8 shots clear and then just be able to coast home on the Sunday. Yeah. Now, it could be completely wrong. I'd love to see him fight it out and win it in the back nine on a Sunday. But
or he could
hasn't played his best.
Or he could come like Quail Hollow.
Come from behind.
Yeah, from deep.
Come from so far off where it's gone on him and that weight of expectation and pressure leaves him and suddenly he's clawing back. Because obviously on the back nine in...
scary.
In Augusta, it can travel like that.
Yeah, like obviously that happened in 2011, but then wasn't he ahead going into the US Open, the next tournament?
Yeah, he was so far
ahead. He has won from all those scenarios that we just mentioned, coming from behind, from a front charging.
But is he less likely to win in a tight finish?
Yeah, well, you know, that's up to how he's seeing things, but I think he's got to be ready for any of those. And
he's in a different place this year. Yeah. That'll give you the real hope. He's absolutely in a different place. He's never been this consistent. He's just been top 10 all the way. It's been outrageous play, really. Anything else you want to point people to that we didn't have time to get to? Or is that about it?
That was about it.
We got through the whole, an hour and 20 minutes without discussing Mayo. Last week, a lot of pieces.
Yeah, actually, that was... I thought it was telling or a bit odd last week, and the Sunday Independent has quite a bit about it today, but last week there wasn't. Yeah. There was very little on it. You wouldn't have known Kerry and Mayo were playing.
I think it took a lot of people by surprise the impact that it had when the green and red and Mayo started blaring and the fans stayed on. Because in the morning I was kind of thinking, look, it's just the lead final, it's not that big a deal. But then when you saw the reaction, it just seemed to be more impactful than certainly I had thought beforehand and maybe a lot of the Sunday papers.
Yeah, I mean, they've had the green and red Mayo playing, but without the cup, you know, it's been at semi-final. I think the second last team to beat Dublin, and I think it was playing out that day. But no, just with the cup and that the players enjoyed that moment. And, you know, they've had a really good league, you know, and they've obviously have to go through Galway, you know, it was the one team they lost in the league. And obviously then there's Dublin, but everything else they did in this league, you know, they got... They started because we're on about consistency. Like Mayo's consistency during the league, particularly over the last 3 or 4 years, have been very erratic. You know, like, but in this campaign, like, I think they beat Cavan at home. The last time they played Cavan at home in the league, they lost. They beat them this time. Monaghan was the same. Roscommon. So, like, they won those games, and they have a very good track record against Kerry. And to follow, you know, Kerry didn't have as much to play for when the game was in Tralee.
I just wonder, for this team, Kieran, is it more a question of not winning a national final, more that it's more beating Dublin?
Oh, yeah, well, like, I wrote as much.
I think more so. I don't think a national final is as much the issue as beating Dublin, because they went up to Dublin to play them in the league this year.
Yeah.
And they were at arm's length. Yeah. That would be my concern.
No, I agree with you. Like,
in
the
long term, that they still have not figured out a way to beat Dublin, or in recent times Galway. So ironically, they win a national title, the league, and got so much good out of it and so much go forward, and critically new players coming through. But that Dublin question, and even now that Galway question, is there in the background.
I think Eamon Sweeney referenced it there, that the 2017 final was probably the best game of football ever. It was incredible, and they made a huge contribution to it. But I remember being on Morning Ireland the morning after it, they had us on, and one of the things, like, I made that point, like, people talk about September. I mean, it's just that matchup, because it has happened in the league as well, and as you say, it happened again this year. But they have, then, you know, that was only 3 months into pouring stroke two, so, you know, that's something they have to figure out. As you say, Galway is more immediate, but that they're... The big thing that I found is that there's, and it was screaming out for the last few years, and I've written as much, it was just screaming out to back the younger players, like a Matty Ruan.
I think what it does is, by winning the league and bringing through Ruan and James Carr, who looks a real prospect, he's got a bit of pace and size and everything about him. What it does is it takes the notion that Mayo are off the cliff edge this year. It takes that away because there is a future beyond 2019.
It's not the
maybe
big
not
squeeze.
For them all. It's not.
Last year felt like a squeeze.
They're very well positioned. They were in an under 20 final last year. They won an under 21 title 3 years ago. Yeah. So they have players coming through. You can you could list 15 that could maybe.
And it's there for them.
And
critically,
in time,
as you said,
over the next 4 or 5 years, and there will be a gap. And I think they can exploit it, but I don't think it will be this year on this Dublin team as well.
Yeah, okay.
Like the big thing for me was again like just how the way the bench was used. I don't think they've had that in previous years. Whereas, you know, the roar that goes up when an Andy Moran comes on, as opposed to in previous years, there wasn't a name. Whereas Dublin were bringing Kevin McManaman, Bernard Brogan in 2017. Like so, they have something to counter that, and it's been the cavalry, as Joe Schmidt calls it, that has won Dublin All-Irelands and big games against Mayo. And I think
they've
Mayo have countered that.
Taking out that Dublin defeat, they've certainly positioned themselves very, very strongly, not just for this year, but I think for 2-3 years. We'll be talking about them again.
Hopefully.
They're not going anywhere.
They're great value. You know, they're one of the great counties to talk about. Gents, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much. So, Kieran Shannon from the Irish Examiner and Colin Keyes from the Irish Independent. That's us done. We're back with the Sunday Papers again next week.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.